Good evening and welcome to another what should be wonderful evening with Venerable Robina. Tonight is the first night of a two-part teaching on self-forgiveness, compassion, and purification. If you're not familiar with Venerable Robina, she is a bit of a firecracker. She's been a nun for more than 35 years. She has a very direct, penetrating, sometimes scary way of teaching, but she's really quite marvelous. I want to just give you a couple of points here. When she comes in, traditionally we stand out of respect for the teacher and the teachings that she holds. And then following that, if you are a regular at Kadampa Center, you're probably accustomed to when Geshe-la comes in, he will prostrate to the altar. And at his request, out of his humility, we prostrate with him. That's not traditional. So when Venerable Robina comes in, she will prostrate and we'll wait until she's seated before we prostrate. Anybody who is uncomfortable with prostrations, you're welcome to have a seat. You don't need to prostrate. This is, again, just an expression of our own humility and our respect for the teachings that she holds. After this two-day teaching, Venerable Robina will be leading a workshop this weekend on how to enjoy death. Who knew we could do that? And what she's teaching is based on this book written by Lama Zopa Rinpoche, which she edited. There are copies of it available in the bookstore if you're planning to come. I also wanted to let you know that she'll stop sometime before the end of the evening and open the floor to questions. And we are streaming this for people online who are unable to be here tonight and recording it. And so if you are asking a question, please, I know it's not natural, but just overcome your shyness. Hold the microphone up close to your mouth, just like you were about to lick an ice cream cone. And that way, the folks who are at home will be able to hear your questions. I also wanted to let you know about a couple of opportunities to travel with Venerable Robina in Asia. She'll be leading a five-day retreat at Borobudur, which is a 9th-century Buddhist temple in Indonesia. That's June 24 to 28. And then in October and November, she'll be leading about 3.5 to 4 week pilgrimage in India and Nepal, where you will visit all the really amazing Buddhist holy sites, Lumbini, the Buddha's birthplace, Srivasti, where he and his disciples would spend 3 months of the year during the rainy season in retreat. I've been on this pilgrimage, and the first time I was at Srivasti, I was really amazed at the thought that I was walking on the same ground that the Buddha had walked on. You'll go to Kushinagar, where he passed, to Rajgir, where he gave the teaching on emptiness at Vulture's Peak, to Bodh Gaya. So it's really quite an amazing trip. And there are postcards where you can get a little bit of information or send away for more information. They're out in the lobby. And there's also a little sign-up sheet if you just wanted to put your email address in there, and we'll send it to Effie, who organizes these trips with Venerable Robina. Okay, and the last thing is just to let you know that at Kadampa Center, we have had a long tradition that we never charge for the Dharma. These teachings are too precious for money to ever be an obstacle for somebody to be able to hear them. Of course, we have expenses to bring the Dharma, so we would welcome if anybody is touched, moved by what you hear from Venerable Robina, and you really feel from your heart that you would like to contribute to our expenses in making this possible, then we would really welcome any donations. There's a box on the wall right outside the Gampa and a box on the desk just inside the door, and you can also give online. And that's it. She should be here any moment. Thank you so much.
Okay, here we go. You do prayers for this one?
On Wednesdays, we say the seven limb prayer, the short mandala offering, and the request to turn the wheel of Dharma, and then the refuge in bodhicitta prayer.
Oh. You better lead them, okay? So if you don't know any of the prayers, just relax, don't worry about it. Hello, Andre.
How are you?
How's your body? Holding up? Getting you here and there?
Hmm?
Getting you here and there?
Getting me here and there.
Good. Okay. So, okay, you do the prayers. Do you explain to people what you do? You just do them. Explain to people, please. Well, tell them what you're doing.
Go ahead, do the prayers?
Yeah, and you tell them what you're doing, though. Explain first.
Okay.
If you don't mind.
Okay.
It's good to explain. Yeah.
Okay. So the first one is the seven limb prayer. And it's on page, in the gold book, it's on page 27.
And if you just want to relax and listen, don't you worry. You do that. No worries.
Okay, and the seven limb prayer is an offering. It's a prayer for the seven limbs. And they're all practices that are antidotes. So, for example, prostration is an antidote to pride. The second line is for offering, which is an antidote to avarice. Confession, the third one, where it says, declare all my negative actions, thus confession for all defilements. Rejoicing is an antidote
Who knows?
Okay. And rejoicing, jealousy, and the request to remain until the end of cyclic existence is an antidote for all faults that you have in relationship with your guru or your lama, and to turn the wheel of Dharma is an antidote to all faults you have in respect to the Dharma or Dharma materials. And then dedication is an antidote, which is the last one, is the antidote to wrong view.
Oh, really? Helen, thank you very much. Most interesting. I didn't know that. Thank you. Let's go.
Okay.
Oh, the rest. Oh, sure. Tell them the rest. Oh, go on.
Well, then the rest is just the short mandala offering.
And that's an offering of all the contents of the universe to the Buddha, as if the Buddha were here himself. It's like a request for something. You offer something, don't you? Then the next one?
The next one is just the request to turn the wheel of Dharma.
Okay.
Yeah. And then the refuge in bodhicitta.
Okay.
Okay. So, page 27. Reverently I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since the beginning of time, and rejoice in the merits of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence, and turn the wheel of Dharma for
living beings.
I dedicate my own merits and those of all others to the great enlightenment. Now turn to page 97. And we'll cite the short mandala offering at the top. This ground anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, the four continents, the sun and the moon, I imagine this as a Buddha field and offer it. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. O holy and perfect Pure Lama, from the clouds of compassion that form in the skies of your Dharmakaya bosom, please release the rain of vast and profound Dharma, precisely in accordance with the needs of those to be trained. Idam Guru Rata Mandala Kamriya Tayami.
Okay. And, yeah, okay. And now we're just taking refuge, the first two lines. And the second two lines are thinking, we're going to listen to these teachings to see some tools we can take from it to help us develop our marvelous potential so we can be of benefit to others. Sangye charang soke chob namla jang cho badu dagni kyab su chi dagi chanyen gipe sonam ki drola penche sangye dropa shog sangye charang soke chob namla jang cho badu dagni kyab su chi dagi chanyen gipe sonam ki drola penche sangye dropa shog sangye charang soke chob namla Jangshu Badu Dagni Kyabsuchi Dagi Chunyan Gipe Sonam Ki Drola Penche Sange Drupa Shog. Okay, so we're going to talk about one of these methods of how we change ourselves, Buddha's whole deal is this amazing thing that he says we can change ourselves to this radical degree, you know. I mean, this is already contradicts so much that we feel instinctively. We feel instinctively, don't we? And in a way, this is reinforced in all of our scientific models and our psychological models. That somehow we're stuck with what we're born with. This is who I am. I'm born this way. What to do? Not my fault, you know. And we kind of trudge along miserably feeling like we can't change much, you know. Internally. We know we can change from knowing music to not knowing music. We know we can learn lots of things, but we don't seem to think we can learn lots of new emotional things, which is kind of curious. I mean, we know you can turn into the most amazing musician, the most amazing physicist, which means radically changing your mind. But when it comes to being less angry, less jealous, forget it. We don't think that's possible, you know. It's very curious, isn't it? I mean, we know we're not stuck with knowledge about music and maths, but we really feel stuck at the emotional level, which is kind of odd. And the Buddha's deal is there's nothing set in stone in this mind of ours, you know. Just nothing set in stone. And not only that, the Buddha's findings, his own experiential findings from his own self, his own hard work internally, he's found that, you know, actually we've got this extraordinary potential to remove every atom of all the rubbish from our minds, every atom of ego and ego grasping and attachment and anger and pride and jealousy, this stuff that we really believe is at the core of our being. He says, no, not in the slightest. And this is a massive point in Buddhism, and it's quite shocking, actually, if we think about it, because it's not how we think in our culture. That we can completely rid our minds of that stuff, and not only that, we can fully develop to perfection, quite literally, all the goodness within us, putting it in a very simple way. So in essence, this is what you're doing as a Buddhist, you know. Developing your own amazing potential to an extraordinary degree so that you become this marvelous person who's effortlessly capable of being of benefit to others, because we all live in this world interdependently, you know. So there's various methods of doing this, of being a Buddhist, of doing this type of changing, if you like. So if we take, you know, the Tibetans have this wonderful way of packaging all the Buddha's practices and teachings in a really nice, coherent structure that really is like a course. The Dalai Lama, His Holiness says, it's a bit like our education system. You know, we know we'd have sort of, whatever you call it, like junior school, high school, university, postgraduate, in music, in math, whatever you want to learn. We know this, we have these systems, these ways of learning something. Well, that's really... interestingly, we don't think of that often in spiritual terms, but here, the Tibetans, and in particular the way we, in our tradition, there's this wonderful packaging, they call it, it's this medieval phrase called the Lam Rim, which means gradual path. Well, you give it a 21st century translation, and that word is a course. And as soon as we hear the word course, we kind of get it, you know. We say Lam Rim, we go, oh yeah, Lam Rim, what's that? Tibetan, gradual path, yeah, what's that? But say it's a course, oh, I get that, you know. And we know in any course, in any subject material, it's the beginning stuff first, the more advanced, and the most advanced. It's obvious, it's kind of obvious. You go from grade 1 to grade 2 to grade 7, and then you graduate. Well, it's exactly the same here. And what this course is a course to become a Buddha. You graduate as a Buddha, basically, which is where you rid of all the rubbish and fully develop all the goodness. I mean... the difference is this course lasts many lives, unless you really advance when you get born. You know, as you know, Buddha talks about reincarnation, so you can easily come into this life well advanced. Like there's one of these wonderful students of Lama Zopa Rinpoche. She's a lama in her own right. She's this amazing Tibetan who's Lama Zopa says she was born with all these realizations. You know, she came into this life as this developed Buddha called Vajrayogini, this amazing blissful being. You know, extraordinary. So you can get born with realizations. You know. There's Diane. Good evening, sweetheart. I'm very happy to see you. I think there's a seat there for you. Okay, so the first level, I like to call it junior school. They call it in this structure the lowest scope of practices, which is a nice, again, arcane, medieval way of saying what I'd call junior school. The practices according to the lowest capability student. That's understandable. So here, this is mainly, we touched on this a bit last night. We almost don't think of it as Buddhist practice. It sounds rather disappointing. It's all about controlling your body and controlling your speech. Like I said, like doing what your grandma says, behave nicely. And this is really shared by any decent human being. A good communist, a good Christian, a good Muslim would not kill, not lie, not steal, not this and not that. Pretty reasonable. But there's a crucial difference in Buddha's view. This is all to do with what Buddha would call the law of karma, you know? And this, what we're going to get to, this topic, is all about that. So we've got to get our head around what that means, you know? So, in these first stages, Buddha would exhort us, the very entry level into Buddhism, the very beginning of it, is he would exhort us to behave nicely, to try and not harm sentient beings. And he articulates it in terms of, initially, seven little things. Very simple. Seven little things. The major ones that impact upon others in a bad way. Like killing, don't kill, don't steal, and don't jump on the wrong partner. You know, if you've got a partner. Okay, if you haven't got a partner, then it's cool. You can sleep around if you like. You're not breaking, you know, you're just probably increasing your attachment. You're not necessarily harming anybody. But it's like not taking someone else's partner, that kind of thing. You're controlling your body. What, in relation to what? Actions that harm others. Pretty obvious. The second lot are four actions of the speech. Like we mentioned yesterday, we often don't even think of speech as a problem. You don't get sent into prison for speech very often. So we hardly think of speech as really harmful. But we can see the harm that speech do, and it's the source of much of our suffering in our own relationships. Then the last three are just the beginnings, I'd like to put it this way, just the beginnings of harnessing the crazy energy of this mind of ours, which is the source of why we do bad things with our body and speech. But the crucial point for the Buddha is this, and this is a massive point in relation to Buddha's entire view and pointing out really the way we approach being a Buddhist. And I did mention this, I think, whatever day it was. That Buddha's not a creator. He doesn't assert a creator. So therefore, morality in Buddhism isn't, you don't be a good person because Buddha says so, which is why you're a good Christian, and that's not wrong. It's an amazing system. By definition, I always quote this from my Jesuit priest friend, by definition, a sin is doing what God said not to do. This priest said, he told me, there's a certain aspect of natural law there that killing hurts others, but the real reason killing is wrong is because God said not to do it. Now, this is a pretty intense point. And it's actually a philosophical position. And Buddha would argue with this one. Because if you think about it, this is the same view you have if you're a materialist. When I'm in my little girl in my mother's household and she says, don't do that. I bet I will say, why not, Mum? And we know her answer. Because I say so. Uh-huh. And you think this is our view, very instinctively, of morality. We then run around the world trying to, you know, the judge says this and the laws say this and the police say this and mummy says this and they say that. We spend our lives trying to know what we're supposed to do because someone else says so. And that's why we get all resentful and rebellious. You know, who do you think you are telling me what to do? Isn't it? And then, of course, the added component is this one. That if we're a good girl and we do what mummy says, and the same with God, we will get rewarded. And we want to be rewarded, and there's nothing wrong with that. So that's the, you know, and then if we're a naughty girl, okay, we can't escape from God, we know that, but we can certainly escape from mummy's eyes. So we feel if we did something naughty but mummy didn't see us, oh look, I got away with it. That's how we feel, isn't it? And we spend our lives doing this. Well, this is a philosophical position. Buddha would say it's really dualistic. And it's not the most fundamental point, he says. So his view of morality, his view of the ethics, is really the natural law business. He says, if you do some market research in this room, guess what? You're going to find 100% agreement. No one likes to get killed, lied to, jumped upon by the wrong person, stolen from, bad-mouthed. You know, I understand. It's pretty obvious. So Buddha would define a negative action at this level, the most broad stroke negative actions, as an action that harms another. That's what he says defines it. But this is the crucial point now I'm getting to. The reason he would exhort us not to do it right at the beginning stages is not because it harms another. That's compassion. That's way too advanced. It's like self-compassion. Because guess what, Rabina? He says, if you're going to kill somebody, lie to somebody, badmouth somebody, you know, harsh speak somebody, guess who you're going to harm first? Yourself. And this is a tough one to get. We kind of vaguely know it, you know, but we're mostly concerned about what other people see, and that's why we're mostly concerned with trying to get away with being naughty. But the Buddha would say that's absurd. You can't possibly get away with it. You can't get away with anything because it's a natural law. And goodness, he would say, and this is the very essence of karma, that goodness, he would say, just naturally will bring its own results to me. It's not punishment, it's not reward. Buddha has no view of punishment and reward because that implies a punisher and a rewarder. And there is nobody like that as far as Buddha's concerned. For him, the law of cause and effect, being good and bad, it's a completely natural law that plays itself out in every single sentient being's mind. And there's no judging. There's nobody to judge. So we become the boss. So the whole business of being accountable, therefore, which is what the view that comes from this, because you know, if you really take on board the view that you don't want to suffer, that you're sick of suffering, and this is a fundamental one in this first stages of practice, we've got to get in touch with this, that you know what, I am sick of suffering. And so then I've got to look at what causes suffering, and Buddha says, guess what, Rabina, your own negative actions will ripen as your suffering. Because the Buddha's view is that every millisecond what we think, do, and say necessarily doesn't go astray, sows seeds in our mind, programs our mind, if you like, and if we don't pull those seeds out, will ripen in the future as our suffering. And our good actions, in exactly the same way, will leave seeds in the mind that will ripen as our future happiness. So literally, as His Holiness often says, it's like self-creation. There's a simple way of saying it. But it's, and of course, the actual process of how it all works is incredibly complicated, highly sophisticated. Only when you're the greatest practitioner will you really get to see the workings of karma. But this is the principle, and this is the fundamental principle of morality in Buddhism. So that what it brings is this real sense of accountability, real sense of being grown up, that I'm the boss, and I have to recognize that I'm sick of suffering, therefore I have to stop doing the actions that cause my suffering. Now, we get this when it comes to the world, to ordinary things. We all are brilliant at diet, brilliant at nutrition. We eat some food that causes a bellyache. There's no way in the world we will ever eat it again because we know we don't want suffering. It's easy to be accountable. Well, unless we're really attached, you know, we keep doing the same old thing and get a headache or get a bellyache, you know, or get too fat or something. But we know the point. There's no moralistic issue there. And as soon as it comes to what we call morality, we get very complicated. It's kind of interesting, you know? So this view of karma is pretty amazing because it demands that we start being accountable. It demands that we start to grow up. That means you stop blaming other people. You stop trying to get away with things because you can't escape from yourself. You can't escape from what your mind does and therefore what your actions do, you know. We are the ones who produce ourselves. This is kind of interesting, really tasty. So it's a bit like too, you know, if you know very well if you go to the doctor and she says you might, well, Bina, don't smoke, you might get cancer. You don't go, well, who do you think you are telling me what to do? We don't say that. We say, thank you, you're so amazingly kind for warning me that I could get cancer. We immediately will want to take her advice. So we don't go home then, and then we notice the doctor's not there, so we get out our Marlboros. Oh, well, she's not seeing me smoke. I won't get cancer. We don't say that. We know that would be absurd. Well, that's the view we have of morality, isn't it? We hide our badness and try to show our goodness because we want to be rewarded and we don't want to be punished, you know? The Buddha says it's not like that. That's childish. When we're little children, it's fine. But eventually we've got to grow up. We're the boss. So the very first level of practice in Buddhism, the entry level. Entry level. Don't even worry about being your own therapist yet, like we talked yesterday. That's kind of more, that's like high school. Like we said yesterday, you can't begin to start working on your mind, which is where the real problems are and where the real goodness is, until you start harnessing your crazy verbal and physical energy. It's kind of obvious, you know. So the very first level of practice is having thought about the Buddha, having taken on board theoretically that you'd like to take karma as your working hypothesis, then you, for your own sake, do not underestimate this, will want to live according to the laws of morality. For your sake. This is so grown up, I tell you. Because you don't want suffering. This takes time because we tend to think, oh, spiritual is all about compassion. Oh, that sounds a bit selfish. Not, yeah, it is, but it's wisely selfish. You know, like, no one accuses you of being selfish by eating well. They admire your wisdom. Well, same here. Same here. This is the very first level, entry level in junior school, I tell you. You refrain from bad-mouthing, harming, killing, lying, stealing. And they're the most obvious, really gross actions. And once you start to get used to that idea, then you get to realize that it also means maybe you don't stuff 14 pieces of cake in your mouth. It's not harming anybody else. Cake doesn't mind. But these actions are going to harm you. Uncontrolled body, uncontrolled speech, you know, harm you. But that takes real time to think, because all we do is we get guilty. Oh, you mean I'm a bad person? So we really got to think of it intelligently, you know, and think about it wisely and intelligently. That's then what enables us to really become this disciplined person. For one's own sake, I can't stress this enough, but this takes time, you know. We can be practicing Buddhists for years and still doing it because we think we're being good girls and we'll get rewarded by somebody. You know? Not like that. So this very first level, given this view of karma of the Buddhas, which is just really this idea, you know, karma is this law of karma. We use the word in Buddhism, and it's even used by most, certainly in the world, but really even among Buddhists, it's used really colloquially and really not accurately, you know. We sort of think of it as a big stick, and we always think of it as about negative things, bad things, you know. But for the Buddha, the law of karma applies to good things. It applies to whatever happens to us. So essentially, Buddha's deal, when it comes to karma, and again, remember where this view comes from. It wasn't revelation. It wasn't revealed to him. He's not speculating. He didn't have a dream about it or a vision. He's observed this with his own mind. He says it's a natural law, like gravity, like botany. It simply occurs. And where does it occur? It occurs in the minds and lives of sentient beings. It's the law of cause and effect. Now, we all understand the law of cause and effect. You know, you make a cup, you get a bit of clay, bit of this, bit of that, bit of heat, and an oven, you get a cup. You know how to, a bit of seed, of this, sun, an earth, and a soil, an earth, and a bit of water, you get a flower. We understand cause and effect. We live our entire lives according to the law of cause and effect. We call it science. Well, Buddha's expertise is the law of cause and effect in relation to happiness and suffering. That's the way Buddha frames the entire thing. So this very first level is, I do not want more suffering. I'm up to here with suffering. Great, Buddha says, I've got some methods for you. Don't kill. Don't lie. Don't steal. Don't this, don't that. A few things. The beginning. Just that. The beginning, you know. But then you can extrapolate from there. And you can start to realize that a negative action also is one that even mightn't harm another, but definitely harms us. And again, it's not guilt. We've got to really look at this, you know. Really look at the implication. Which means we'll get to know our minds eventually much more. So the very first level of practice then is, okay, given that the Buddha says basically this is the karma business, you know. First of all, we take on the board the view that our consciousness is not physical. Our mind, our consciousness, not physical. Second, doesn't come from mummy or daddy, doesn't come from a superior being. This is a fundamental point for the Buddha, absolutely. To take it on board as a hypothesis. It can't be easily proved. It's quite subtle. Third, this consciousness of ours, as we've discussed already, goes to way more subtle levels of cognition. The job of our mind is to cognize things. It goes to much more subtle levels of cognition, which we access using these marvelous meditation techniques that we mentioned yesterday, made up by these Hindus that the Buddha uses, and Buddhists to the present day use these amazing techniques, particularly the concentration meditation technique. And then finally, the most radical point of Buddha's at all about the mind is its potential, this potential for perfection, this potential for Buddhahood. Sangye, like I mentioned yesterday, I think, whatever. The etymology of this word is very tasty. The Tibetan word for Buddha, Sangye, Buddha is Sanskrit. The first syllable implies the utter eradication from one's mind of all the rubbish, and the second syllable implies the development to perfection of all the goodness. A simple way of putting it, this is the point of all of these practices on this Mahayana path of Buddhist teachings that we're discussing here. This is a long-term goal. So, then, what Buddha's saying is this. Every millisecond of whatever goes on in any sentient being's mind, and sentient being is a big category. For the Buddha, there are trillions of sentient beings. in many what they call realms of existence. Humans, animals, other beings called gods, other beings called spirits, other beings called hell beings. There's a whole spectrum of type of living beings, all of whom, every single one of whom, is just necessarily experiencing every millisecond the fruit of their past actions, and every millisecond is sowing the seeds that will produce their future actions. This is the Buddha's deal, the self-creation business, you know. Every millisecond of what is labeled a negative action, and we'll go into this precisely, necessarily leaves a seed in the mind that, unless you pull it out, will ripen as your future suffering. Every sentient being is the same. And every millisecond of what is called a virtuous action leaves a seed in the mind, unless you weaken it or make a mess of it, will ripen as your happiness. And then given, of course, that simply speaking, without any drama, we don't want suffering and do want happiness, but let's even look at what that means, then clearly we have to use the methods that will prevent us from having suffering and will give us what's called happiness. So we, obviously, if we're in charge of our lives, and not just being good girls and boys to be rewarded or punished, we better learn these rules. If you want a garden, in other words, you better learn to be a gardener. Don't just hope that someone gives you a nice garden. Because I like to think of, they always use the thing of seeds and fruits when they talk about karma. And you think of your life as your garden. Whatever's in it, you caused, you sowed the seed. It's a really such an intense view, you know. It really takes time to think about it. We're used to the concept of being a materialist, or certainly we're used to the concept of being created by somebody. It takes a while to process this view. But this is the essence of Buddha's view. And all this stuff plays in the mind. And it's a natural law. No one runs it. No one's pulling the strings. No one's punishing. No one's rewarding. And it's not random. If it's a natural law, it's got to be coherent and consistent, because all laws are like that. So, okay, if a negative action is one that will ripen as my suffering, and I'm sick of suffering, then we better learn to know what a negative action is. Pretty reasonable. So, okay, what's a negative action? Well, first of all, broad stroke, like I said, definition is one that harms another, which is the stuff that Buddha would exhort us not to do in the beginning. But the reason, he says, is because it's going to harm you. So then we can begin to look more deeply at what a negative action is in relation to even things that just you do yourself with your body and speech and your mind. Because the word action is this word karma. But the tasty way to understand the meaning, the essential heart meaning of the word karma, is it begins with the mental action. And that's called intention, like volition, will, the thought in the mind, the starting point of everything. My wanting to walk out that door. My legs will do the job, but guess where it starts? With the thought, I will walk out the door. If I'm sitting here thinking I will sit in the chair and my legs pick me up, I'll get a big surprise. So everything starts with the thought. But this is a million seconds, you know, a million times a second. We don't even notice these intentions because we're completely programmed with so many. That's what we call instinct. So we don't even notice intention. That's the starting point. Mental action. And then our body and our speech, for many of the things we do in our life, coming, you know, are like the servants of our mind. So the thought of I will walk out the door, then my legs pick me up and I look in that direction, and there's a million parts of my mind all working beautifully in hand to get that action done. You know, but it starts in the mind. And you could say there's no karma if the mind isn't involved. This is a very interesting point, and we're going to look into this now. Okay, so there's many ways, there are four main ways, broadly speaking, in which our actions, mental actions, actions that we do, starting with the mind and the body and speech, will ripen in the future. Four ways. I mentioned this briefly, I think, a couple of days ago. The first one is the what they call the fully ripened result, which is the type of rebirth we get. And this is determined before we even die. We're going to discuss this process of death and how important the time of death is for all sentient beings in terms of determining what their future life will be. We're going to discuss that this weekend. It's really important to know for yourself and therefore to know how to help other people die, you know. But this is also the seed that will be triggered from these bank vaults of trillions of seeds that we're lugging around from life to life to life, because no seed goes astray. One of these trillions of seeds will be triggered before we even stop breathing in this life. That will be the one that will program us to go into our next mummy's human womb, you know. The second way our karma ripens is all the tendencies in that mind. So in our case, let's say here we are, we're humans, you know? And we can deduce that in our past life, which is not more than a few weeks before our mind hit our mother's fallopian tubes, wherever it was. That's what I heard. The egg and sperm joins in the fallopian tube, is what I've heard. I didn't know that, but there you go. So it would have been soon before we stopped breathing in the past life, which is no more than, you know, it could probably no more than a few weeks before we were conceived in our mother's womb, in this present life. My mummy's human womb. You know, sitting there in bed with my daddy, Billy and Daddy, Billy and Teddy. My mother was Agnes. Agnes Bliss. And then she became, and her mother, they called her Billy because they wanted a boy, I think. So she was Billy Bliss. And she was lying in bed with her hubby, my daddy, Teddy Corton. And I've deduced it's about May 1944, because I came out December 20, a couple of months early. So I've deduced that around about May 1944, my mummy and daddy hopped into bed, right? So this consciousness that zapped into their egg and sperm at the moment of conception, that's what conception is in general. A few weeks before that was in another body, could have been a dog's body, could have been an elephant's body, who knows. The consciousness at the time of death was very specific, which we'll talk about in the weekend. A karmic seed was triggered, that was the virtuous karmic seed from strong morality in the past, particularly not killing, not, you know, non-harming, virtuous karmic seed, nourished, as Lama Zopa Rinpoche says, by strong practice and keeping vows of morality, not as an elephant, but from a previous life. That particular seed was triggered, that programmed that consciousness, even before I stopped breathing, as an elephant, you know, to go to my mummy, you know, Billy's womb a few weeks later. The second bunch of karmic seeds that were triggered at the time of that death, that were all the tendencies of Robina. All her personality traits, her characteristics, her tendency to get angry, her tendency to be good at whatever she was good at, you know, good at good or bad, good at tennis, good at music, good at killing, good at loving, good at being a liar, all of these tendencies, all my millions of karmic tendencies, tendencies of my personality, meaning mummy and daddy did not give me a personality. And this is a big shock to us because we believe they made us. This is programmed before I even passed away as the elephant. Mother and father didn't even think about me yet. The third lot of karmic seeds, all these trillions of karmic seeds that would have been triggered simultaneously, were all the seeds that are called experiences similar to the cause, which were really all the experiences from the second of conception, from the second that I popped out my mummy's womb, all the experiences at the hands of others in this life. Meaning from mummy, daddy, my siblings, my auntie, my uncle, my grandpa, the Catholic nuns, the people on the train I met, the ones who punched me in the nose, the ones who love me, give me things, hate me, all the sentient beings we meet in this life, including the ants that, you know, eat your house and the cockroaches that eat shit in your spoon drawer and the rats that eat your, you know, underneath your kitchen sink. They're your sentient beings. They're your karmic connection. Hello, rat. Hello, cockroach. They're your sentient beings. We've got very strong history with each other. There's no random event. You're not possible to meet a cockroach that you haven't met before and whom you haven't harmed before. It's not possible to meet a person who gives you $100 whom you haven't been kind to before. It's not possible to meet a rapist who harms you whom you haven't harmed before, because Buddha says karma is a natural law. All this is programmed before I left the elephant's body. The fourth one is called environmental karma. That all the way the physical world will impact upon me in this life. Whether my body's healthy, not healthy, whether food nourishes me, doesn't nourish me, whether where I go or live is tasty or ugly or depressing or, you know, whatever it might be. So the entire way the physical world impacts upon you, the entire way every sentient being you ever meet impacts upon you, sees you, loves you, hates you, all your own tendencies and your own humanity. Who created this? Me. We're the boss, baby. And I love being the boss. So I like the Buddha's view. We create ourselves, Buddha says. All this occurs before you even stop breathing, which is why, as Lama Zopa says in this book, the most important time to help a person is when they're dying. That's when they need you most. Why? It's because that's when the next life is determined. If you take the Buddha's view of reincarnation, you know, it's a crucial time. And Rinpoche's book is about that. And we're going to discuss that this weekend. So all that's programmed even before I stop breathing. You're already on autopilot, you know. These things can help you change, but pretty much it's set by then. So, okay, so if we look simply at our lives and go, well, do I want to be sick all the time? No, thank you. Well, then Buddha says, well, I've got a solution. It's like those health food shops that the homeopaths are really clever. They put all the little bottles of medicines, then they've got a little book and you look up the disease in alphabetical order. Arthritis. Okay, take this, this, and this, you know? Oh, okay, good. Look up the illness and you look up the solution. Well, the same here. Buddha says, do you want to have a healthy body when you live in the... Do you want to have a human body next life, Rabina, as opposed to a dog's body? Yes, please. Well, honey, you look up the solution and it's don't kill. Mostly, don't kill. Good enough. Okay, I'll do that. I want a human body. Good enough. Then he says, well, do you want to be killed by others or die young? No, thank you. Well, again, don't kill. Well, this is the second one. The third one, the experiences. Do you want a tendency to keep killing? That'd be a bit of a disaster. No, thank you. Then don't kill. Do you want a really healthy body and lovely food and delicious food and nice water and delicious air? Thank you, yes. Solution, don't kill. Because each of those four, there are results from killing. Then let's say you would like to, would you like people to not lie to you? Thank you very much. I would like that. Would you like people to not distrust your words? Thank you. I would. Then, Rabina, don't lie, baby. Would you like people to give you nice things and live in a nice environment where your mummy's got money in the bank and not have to work 18 hours a day for a bowl of rice? So, yes, I would. Then don't steal and you better be generous, honey. But it's not complicated. There's only about seven things. You can broad stroke, look at those seven things, and they'll give you the results that you want, you know. It's not complicated. So, of course, you've got to take it on board as your hypothesis. You can't prove it yet. It's a bit soon. But it's a good start. So, this is the Buddha says we're in charge, you know. So, you've got to know you don't want suffering. And that is real. I mean, suffering's real. What's suffering? In ordinary daily life, what's suffering? People being mean to us. People lying to us. You know, if you're in a country where people hate you because of your race or because of the shape of your leg or something, you know. Do you want that? No, thank you. Do you want people to steal from you? No, thank you. Do you want to be poor and struggle to survive? No, thank you. It's simple. Don't be all holy about it. Well then, honey, I have some methods for you, he says. So this is the way you live as a Buddhist. Because you do not want suffering. So that brings real self-respect, you know. Real respect for yourself. Self-compassion is a great way to put it. So then, of course, when we apply this law of karma and we look at our life now and we see some of these results, we'll know the cause of it. Which is painful when it's the bad stuff, but it's when it's good stuff, we will be so delighted. But you know what? The tragedy is when it comes to karma, because of like we talked yesterday, ego is a junkie for the misery. We never think of karma when it comes to good things. I say this, and I mean it with sincerity. I'm not trying to show off here, but I've been a Buddhist about 40 years. And I have never, in those 40 years, I have to say this to you seriously, I go to many countries, meet many people, I have never, ever, 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 ever had a person say to me, Rabina, why do good things happen? We only ever, ever, ever ask, why do bad things happen? We always, why does that innocent baby have a mean mother? Why does that poor animal get suffering? We never say, Rabina, why is there this beautiful baby with a loving mother and kind family and money in the bank? Why does that happen? It's kind of intensely interesting, you have to admit, isn't it? Which proves we're a junkie for misery. It proves it. Why do we only ask the bad, you know? And you know why? There's an underpinning thing. Because we have this is the ego, this is the tragedy of ego. There's this profound assumption that I deserve happiness and I do not deserve suffering. Kind of interesting. Why would we assume that? The Buddha's view of karma, it's like saying, you know, you deserve a beautiful garden with flowers and vegetables in it, and you do not deserve a garden with weeds. Well, if you own the garden as yours, it's not a question of deserve. If there are weeds in it, it's your garden, honey. You must have grown them. If there are no flowers, it's your garden, then you must have not grown the flowers. So you don't look around for who to blame, who gave you a lousy garden. It's your garden. But this takes time, because we're addicted to guilt and blame and all the other rubbish, you know. So this is quite an intense point. Are we communicating?
Yes.
Got to really think about this one. I remember one time in Kopan Monastery, at one of the big courses there, and I was talking about this stuff, and one very sweet lady in a wheelchair, She was in tears, and she said, "You mean I'm the blame for this?" So I thought about how to answer her. And I said, "Yes, you are the blame for why you're a beautiful human being with a lovely heart and kind friends and good qualities and a wish to practice a spiritual path and a job and you know, and good characteristics. Yes, you are the blame." And she heard me. Because you are the blame for why you're good. You are the blame for why you're sitting in this room, which is unbelievable. Not because you're being a Buddhist. I don't care if you're a Buddhist. But you're actually considering being a good human being. This is stupendous in this insane asylum of this earth. You should be weeping in tears of unbelievable gratitude to your incredibly hard work at morality and goodness and practicing spiritual path in a past life, which is the cause of why we're sitting here this second discussing this stuff. Which should blow our minds. But like we talked yesterday, we only notice the bad. We only notice what's missing, you know. I'm not this and I'm not that. And we notice the bad. We notice the bad. I'm jealous. I'm angry. You mean I'm the blame. We just can't help it. It's the irony of ego. We run like a magnet to the bad stuff, you know. But karma refers to everything. Karma is a natural law like botany that refers to all your flowers and your veggies as well. But we take them for granted. We take them for granted. This is a tragedy, you know. So thinking this way really forces us to think differently. Therefore, to truly appreciate our extraordinary good qualities, our incredible good fortune, not because somebody gave it to you, you're not the gift of the universe or a creator. You're the product of your hard work. Unbelievable, really and truly. We should be so delighted. And yes, indeed, a few rubbish habits, you know, eating too much food, like you want to kill, lie, terrorize, murder, rape. No. You just get a bit attached to food, okay? Thank you. Not too bad. Don't worry about it. You might kill an ant occasionally. You maybe have an abortion occasionally. But, you know, a whale, poor little whale, who's now due to negative karma from having killed in the past, is born with this big fat body, living in the ocean. It opens its mouth for one mouthful of one breakfast in one moment, and it eats 40 million sentient beings. Now, that's good at killing. Excuse me. We might have one abortion and want to kill ourselves, how bad we are. Animals spend their lives killing or being killed. That's due to the imprints in their minds. That's the tragedy of their lives, you know. No choice. That's tragic. Look at the number of humans who kill without even thinking about it because of the habit to kill. So we should be so delighted, you know. So, recognizing this, that I do not want more suffering. I'm up to here with suffering. This is a gross level of suffering. This is like junior school level of suffering. The Four Noble Truths, Lord Buddha's teachings, the first noble truth is there is suffering. And he lays out three levels. This is the first one. Ordinary, in-your-face suffering when the bad things happen. And this is, Buddha would lay out the causes. So even without any thinking, if you're not even sure about, you know, whether you can be an elephant or a dog or something. But we all know I don't want to be bad-mouthed by other people, lied to, stolen from, disliked because of the colour of my skin or the shape of my nose or something. We know we don't want that. Because we see the experience. It's so painful. So then we have to look at the causes, you know. We know we want the good things. Look at the causes. This is junior school. So what they're doing in junior school at this very first level is refraining from sowing more seeds that will ripen as your future suffering. This is stupendous. Fundamental. Starting point practice. The foundation all the way. Then you can do it in a very tasty way. This is where now the Lord Buddha talks about vows. He loves his vows. The Lama Zabrushi waxes lyrical about vows. And this again takes time. So we'll look into this, how we create karma and what the power of vows. So we've never got what we're going to get to. After this, you learn to refrain from putting more negative seeds in particular by living in the context of vows in a spiritual practice, which was like a rocket boost under your tendencies. Then we get to, still in junior school, this other practice, which is where we have to take care of all the negative seeds we've already planted. Way back when, we're lugging around these bank vaults. And we don't want these karmic seeds to ripen as our suffering in the future. And that's what purification is. You live your life like this, you can sit back with your feet up and eat popcorn all day. You're going to die a good die, a good death. Well, a few extra things you need to do. But living in vows and purifying, if you do these two, it is an amazing practice. You can relax and you'll die well and you'll have a decent future life and keep on moving on your spiritual path. Guaranteed. Karma's a natural law. So let's look at how we create an action. I mean, there's one various ways of looking at this. And how this whole process of what is a negative action, how do you define it? I mean, you have to analyze. You've got to look into it more deeply, you know. So, okay. What they call a complete... I need some water. So, a complete negative action, and indeed a positive action, has four components. And this, a complete action, is one that will leave a seed in your mind that naturally, like all seeds, will start to grow and expand and bring many fruits of, in particular, a suffering type of rebirth, meaning an animal birth, etc. So a typical example would be an action of killing, let's say. And this is exactly the same logic for a virtuous action of, let's say, non-killing. Same discussion applies. So there's four main components. And the first one, there has to be, let's say, that mouse in my kitchen. There has to be a living being, the object. Has to be there, a living being. The second part, and there's three parts to this, and this is the central part, where the mind is engaged in it. And there are three parts to the second piece. That is, the first bit is, there has to be a state of mind, and there's these many states of mind that are functioning all the time that enable us to do anything at all. And one of the crucial ones happening every millisecond is called discrimination or recognition. And it's happening a million times a second. You know, as we're looking here, I'm seeing red, white, blue, prayer flag, people. It's this constant clarity that's distinguishing this between this, between this and that. So, you know, here you'd have to have this discrimination or recognition that says it is that mouse. The second one is the word intention. And we often use that word to mean motivation or reason, but intention here is, like I said before, volition. It's the word I will. So there has to be the thought, the second part is the intention, I will kill that mouse. The third, and this is the central part, the central piece, the main component, is the, as we call it in the West, the reason why you're going to kill the mouse. As they call it, the Buddhists, the motivation that impels you to kill the mouse. And here, obviously, for a typical action, a complete action of killing, so that it sows a seed in the mind, a negative seed that will ripen as my suffering rebirths in the future, it has to be obviously a negative motivation. And there's, broadly speaking, the three main delusions: attachment, aversion, or ignorance. Well, ignorance might be if I think that killing is good and will help me get enlightened. That's ignorance. Just plain stupid. The typical ones are attachment or aversion. So the fisherman fishes not out of anger. They don't hate fish. They love fish. But they're attached to this whole scenario, you know? So if attachment were the reason I'd kill the mouse, that'd be because I like to eat mouse flesh for lunch. So I'll catch the mouse, and of course you don't kill it with a disgust, because you're so excited. Oh, be careful, don't harm it. Kill it nicely, because have nice, you know, you don't want to mangle its meat, isn't it? That would be attachment. Aversion is obviously the one. Oh, how disgusting, a mouse in my kitchen. It's called anger, basically. Aversion, disgust. And so these three together, the recognition, there's the mouse, intention, I'll kill that mouse, and the one that gives it the flavor, that gives the entire character to the action I create, is the motivation. These three happen so simultaneously, don't they? The third point is, I kill the mouse. The fourth point is, great, one dead mouse. Strictly speaking, it's got to die before you, so you can rejoice and say, look, dead mouse. Now, an action of non-killing is identical. Same components. And one action of non-killing is a moral action. That's a virtuous action. And that'll bring many results of a type of decent rebirth. So that will be exactly the same thing. First, there's a living mouse. Second, there's the recognition. That is the mouse I will avoid killing. The second is intention. I will avoid killing that mouse. The third is motivation, compassion. The fourth is you pick it up, The fifth is you let it out. The fourth is, third is you pick it up and save it. And the fourth is you throw the mouse out. It says, thank you, Rabina, bye. Happy little mouse going off. That's a complete action of non-killing. Those four have to be there. Now we can see, there's, you know, like Venerable Tenrin might have a mouse in her kitchen and she doesn't even see it. So the first one's there, object, a living mouse. Second one, she no recognition because the mind's not seeing it. No intention because she doesn't see it, and no motivation. Third is she does the action, goes on the ground. Fourth is dead mouse. But there is no karma. There cannot be, because the mind isn't engaged, because mind creates karma and is just simply supported by the body and speech. You might even, you look at the two people both standing on a mouse. You wouldn't have a clue if something's in her mind or in my mind. That's why you can't judge. But her, there's zero karma for her, and me, heavy negative karma. And then third person, let's say, you know, what's your name?
Michaela
has a mouse. And this is an interesting one. She has a mouse. Same. One, there's a living mouse. Two, her mind's involved. The first one is recognition. That is the mouse I will kill. Second, I will kill that mouse. Third, motivation, compassion. Poor little mouse. I can't bear it. It's suffering. And so she, third, she does the action. Fourth, dead mouse. And she's rejoicing because now the mouse is stopping suffering. She thinks. There is no negative karma there. There can't be. Even Geshe Sobha said, even if you do kill a human because you're forced to, if your mind doesn't want, you can't say it's a complete action of killing. But here, the motivation is the key. It doesn't mean you run around killing people with a good motivation. That's not what's being said. Just leave sentient beings alone, please. But what I'm saying here is looking at these components, and the key component that determines the character of your action. This is particularly the Mahayana motivation. The key component that determines the kind of the flavor that gives the character to the action, that is to say, is it a negative or positive one, mostly, that determines the seed you plant, that determines the future result, it's the motivation. Not even the intention, it's the motivation. But most of the time the motivation is mixed completely with our intention and we don't even separate them. So, you know, even we don't even notice we're doing things. I mean, we're doing so many of these. Like, I'm sitting there having lunch with Venerable Tenrin, and I feel a tickle, I go like this. Without even blinking. The four things took place. I recognized there was a mosquito. I recognized that's a mosquito. I had the intention, I will kill the mosquito. Motivation, disgust, how dare it take one tiny drop of my blood. Third, I did the action. Fourth, I noticed it's dead. Splat. That's a complete action of killing. We do much of our stuff, isn't it, with no, almost not even aware. But it's because we're programmed with it. That's a complete action of killing. And even worse, because it's so habitual. So virtuous action is the same. Of course, you can have another person kill a mouse, you know, who, let's say, sees the mouse and is really sadistic and can't wait to torture it. And wants to torture the mouse, but the mouse gets away. Well, even though they didn't kill the mouse, it's not a complete action, but heavy duty in the imprints in their mind, you know. Because there's not a single thought we have that goes astray. This is the point. Every millisecond we're creating karma. We're programming our mind every millisecond. We are programming our mind, and the actual programming process itself is highly sophisticated. And this is a natural law. So this is why, from the Buddhist point of view, we have to learn intricately and deeply these laws of karma, and intricately and deeply learn Buddhist psychology so we can know our own mind and begin to be in control of our own lives, you know. We are the boss. So it's kind of intense. Any questions about that so far?
Hey, Venerable. Thanks mm-hmm. for being here. I'm sorry, this is a really personal, specific question, but it drives me batty every time I hear about this. I love cats and dogs. I seem to get some that are allergic to fleas, so I try flea combing them. I try stuff to keep the fleas off. If they get on me, I pick them off. I never kill things. And then, but they get allergic, and I have a cat that gets absolutely covered in scabs, and the dog goes crazy, and what do I do, you know?
You tell me. I'm not going to get you off the hook. I can't. That's not my job. You heard what I said. What do you think? Just tell me some things.
I really don't know because the cat, I mean...
But tell me some more things. Well, tell me how you can get rid of fleas without hurting them. Why can't you get rid of fleas without hurting them?
I've tried everything
well,
I could think of.
Well, you've got to do more researching in the internet. I know nothing about that. So look in the internet to see. I bet you...
Well, I've done
you see,
that.
The key point here is... This is why I can't get you off the hook. I can't say I don't know what to do. First of all, it's a dilemma. This is life. Sweetie... Just existing, you're killing millions of beings, okay? Just breathing, walking, driving. We're killing trillions of beings. Somebody did some research one time, some fellow in Holland, on how many creatures get smashed up by the cars. I'll tell you the story. Someone does this Facebook page, I don't look that often, but I posted a picture of me in this cheese shop in Liverpool, in England, and it was amazing cheese. I eat cheese and everything, and this amazing cheese store, and it was kick-ass cheddar. So then all these fundamental vegetarians and vegans started going at me. How dare a Buddhist nun eat cheese? And all this kind of thing, you know. And I didn't want to be too fundamentalist about it and be political. So I Googled about killing creatures on cars, and this fellow's done, you know, sure enough, someone's done the research. So he discovered it was like on a small amount of road over a small period, like trillions of little creatures get slaughtered by just on the number plate. And I refrained from saying vegetarians and vegans drive cars, you know? You understand? Because sometimes vegetarians and vegans get a bit fundamentalist and a bit political, which is very rude, I think. So nevertheless, what I'm getting at is, just existing, sweetheart, you're killing trillions. You're killing trillions. Just by existing. There are creatures living all over our body. Apparently, because they love our... Some creatures love our face because the pores are kind of big, like little caves, and they'll live in there. They love it, you know? Our mouth's like a living zoo. Underarms are a zoo, you know? So the fact is we're killing just by existing. So that's why the Lord Buddha's thing is at least start with the thought, I will not kill. And that means when you meet living beings, you do everything in your power attempting to not kill. Now the trouble is if you have animals that attract fleas, and then you have a garden that you have to grow flowers in, you're already creating a dilemma for yourself. So honey, it's up to you to decide. It's up to you to decide what... You've got to take responsibility if you want to. About this. You say it makes you crazy because you're trying to find a way to get off the hook. I'm not being mean to you. You've got to really look at your life. If you are an alcoholic and you live with people who drink alcohol, you can't keep complaining that, oh, what can I do? It's not my fault I keep drinking alcohol. You've got to decide that you've got to leave that person. You've got to decide you've got to change your condition, which you don't be forced to kill. That's your call. So if your attachment to bloody cats and dogs is so severe, you've got to decide, look at your life, you know. I always say I'm not being rude, but I am being rude. But are you still hearing my point? This is your life. This is your call. This is you deciding what your priorities are, how you want to live your life, what is most important. I'm very happy you love cats and dogs. I mean, I don't know what to say to you. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's not easy, darling, but my suggestion is this. The first step has to be, if you live according to this stuff, the first step has to be, and this is the very first entry-level junior school, pre-junior school, you will decide, I will try my best not to harm any living being. This is the beginning point. If you ask, I remember one lama, he was asked one piece of advice out of all of Buddhism. Try not to harm sentient beings. This has to be your starting point. If that truly is your starting point, then once you've decided that, you will find methods to help you not kill sentient beings. But if you can't, then you've got to make a decision to change your job. Like people who go and kill billions of beings in their job. They've got no choice. They've got to stop if they really want to be authentic. And try. But it's difficult. It's not easy. And it's not reward. It's not judgment. It's not guilt. It's not shame. It's learning to look at our lives and making calls, making decisions, deciding what our priorities are. Do you see?
Yeah, thank you.
Do your best, darling. Meanwhile, you blow mantras on the fleas, you blow mantras on your animals, but look and really look at methods. And I bet, because we're all so intelligent, I bet there are many methods of getting rid of fleas without trying to harm them. Mice, cockroaches, everything. That's one. Now, interestingly, too, there's also the business of purification. If you think of it this way, we're going to talk more. If there's no sentient being that you meet, and this really sounds cosmic to us, but this is the Buddha's deal. If you follow through logically on this natural law, if there's no sentient being that you meet that's an accident, that's your fleas, honey. Hi, fleas. Welcome home. I'm happy to meet you again. I must have harmed you in the past, or you've harmed me in the past. So I've got a karmic debt, you know. I mean, some people have cats and never get fleas, maybe. Some people have houses with no mosquitoes. No, some people even meet mosquitoes and don't get bitten. So it's personal. So don't see them as fleas out there who wretchedly come along and make your life a drag. They're your fleas, honey. So then if you start to recognize that whatever you do, in anything that happens to you is due to karma you created, that means you created the cause from the past of harming fleas. These sentient beings. This is where the purification practice comes in, which we're going to talk about. So by regretting from the depths of your heart, when your practice at the end of the day, any harm you've done to these sentient beings in particular, you deeply regret from the depths of your heart. Then you strongly purify. Then you strongly determine, I'll do my best possible not to kill. Don't be surprised, the fleas might even go away. Because karma's not set in stone. Because whatever you meet, and the point about the four opponent powers, which we're going to talk about, the four opponent powers, which is the purification, regret, particularly, and there's different interpretations of these by the lamas, but this one I like, regretting an action you did to that sentient being creates the cause for that sentient being not to do it back to you. So you'll purify the one called experiences similar to the cause, which is these fleas, you know, eating your precious animal that you feel forced to kill. And indeed, you're helping the dog purify too, being bitten and harmed by the fleas. You can help them. Do you see? If we take karma seriously, we think it through like this. And then when you have deep regret, first for your sake, you've got to regret because regret is, I don't want the future suffering that will come from me harming these fleas. You've got to know that yourself from the depths of your heart. And then second, you have compassion. And that can help purify the environmental karmic result, which is, you know, being harmed and you're getting sick and stuff. Third, you do the practice, like I say, there's different practices, but the one we all do is this particular mantra that purifies the lower realm karma. And fourth is by vowing not to do again, you learn to change your habits and stop doing. This is where you really apply the laws of karma, practically, you know. Do you understand?
Yeah, good.
So have confidence. Go deep into it, see if you can find ways of having a dog and no fleas. You never know. I bet people have done lots of research, and we're all very intelligent. And if we really want something, we will find the method. I promise. You've got to want to not want to harm first. And don't be scared of that. Do you see what I'm saying? Because that'll open the door to lots of things. Are we communicating, people?
Yes.
It's a dilemma for many people, this one, isn't it? It must be. Who else? Yes.
Hi. This is kind of personal, but I think you touched on it, and I really got to be clear on it. I got two elderly parents.
Parents. You want to kill them too?
Well, no. Well, they have what's called a living will.
And I understand.
They have specific instructions, and I haven't read them. I just know what they kind of are, and it's like if they get to that state, you know, it's me and my brother who would be in charge of like following.
So they want you to kill you. They want you to kill them.
Well, basically, yeah, if it gets to that point, you know, it's up to me or my brother to pull the plug. And I was like, well...
No, sorry. Do they want you to do it, or they're leaving you to make the decision?
They're leaving us... I'm not clear on that.
Well, you better read their will, hadn't you?
Okay. But what if it was... What if it is leaving... I think it's leaving it to me.
Well, then, honey, you got to decide... Again, same with your fleas.
Right.
And this is where we've got to look at the... Okay, we've got to look at the consequences. So let's look at that. We can discuss that. We'll certainly discuss this in more detail on the weekend.
Okay.
Are you going to be there?
Yeah, now
okay.
I will.
Okay, good. But this is exactly the point that we have to think about, because it's a common thing. So we've got to look at the view of karma. Let's look at it a bit now, even. Let's look at it. Okay. So back to who was it who killed the mouse with compassion? You did.
Michaela.
Michaela killed the mouse with compassion. Yeah, keep your hand ready for the next question. Okay, keep it ready. So, okay, let's look at Michaela's action of called euthanasia, basically, isn't it?
Right.
You kill your mummy and daddy out of compassion, she kills the mouse. And this is something that's totally normal in our culture. We see it as good. We see it as noble, isn't it? Poor old vets these days, they spend half their lives killing creatures. It's kind of tragic, you know. So, of course, from the materialist point of view, it is faultless. It is indeed compassion. You can say that. Because if the consciousness of the mouse and your mummy does actually cease when they stop breathing, then of course it's a no-brainer. Please kill me now if I'm going to be suffering. But we've got to look at why it is we have such resistance to this. If it really is true that we are materialist, the material, and there's no mind that does continue, if that is true, do you understand? Say Buddha's wrong. Then of course it's reasonable. But look at it's how interesting how it's such a huge topic and there's such resistance to it. We've got to look at that, why it is deeply down, you know, deep down why it is. But anyway, the point is the Buddhist view is very clear, very clear. Like I just said, before you even stop breathing, and this we're going to go into the death process during the weekend, and it's a really difficult time because another whole thing that happens at death. In the Vajrayana teachings, they have this description of the death process, which is really good to know, and it's divided in terms of 8 stages. The gradual deconstruction of the person, you know. First the eye consciousness ceases, then the ear consciousness, then this happens, and then you're gradually losing the plot. By the time you stop breathing, all the sensory consciousness has ceased, and you've lost the plot. By that point, you haven't got a clue who you are, and your breathing stops. And then, of course, for the West, we're dead by then. But you're not dead yet for the Buddha. This could be several days. You go on to what they call subtle consciousness, and there's more to go before you finally leave the body. Okay, so the point is that before you stop breathing, there's another whole process. From the Sutra teachings of Lord Buddha, the 12 links of dependent arising, which is a whole particular teaching. And every millisecond we're creating these sets of 12 links, which is what we're, every day, based upon different these steps, we're perpetuating countless lives of future lives, every second. But Lama Zopa says, in particular, at the time of death, the craving and grasping, which are 8th and 9th links, which occur every second of the day, and they're just intense levels of attachment, they're unbelievably powerfully strong at the time of death. And they play a very powerful role. And they are the reason most people die with terrible fear, because there's so much attachment. And if you think of one of the functions of attachment is to hold on to what we've got, isn't it? We know that one. And also a bigger function of attachment is to always look forward to something. It's like this perky kind of, oh, now I'll do this and now I'll do that and now I'll have lunch and I'll go here, then I'll get up and I'll go to the work and I'll go, then I'll retire, then I'll have a pension, then I'll go here, you understand? Always making plans, right? And that's looking forward to something. Do you understand? That's attachment. And you know what depression is? When that's the bubble has burst, there's nothing to look forward to because there's no attachment energy. Do you understand? So attachment's massive. Well, at the time of death, guess what? You've never thought about death. You've lived in denial of it because you can't stand the thought. And now finally, it's dawning on you that all you've got to look forward to is a black hole, which is what most materialists think. Well, of course, you're going to have this rampant terror clinging like a vampire to your body, your life, to anything. This is how most people die. It is tormented. Excuse me. You understand?
Yeah.
Now, you don't want your mummy to die like that, darling. And this is how most people do die if they've never thought about death. So this is why the weeks and months before, and then this time in particular, is why you are utterly necessary to your beloved mummy and daddy, you know? So, okay. We're going to talk more on the weekend, but what happens is, what I'm getting at is, when this grasping, which is an intense extra level of attachment, it kicks in, that is what triggers the karmic seed that will throw you into the next life. That's the mechanism, you know? And that's when the most fear is, and that's when you're needed most. So the fact is, most dogs, most ants, most fish, most humans, this is natural. Even if we're Buddhist practitioners, this attachment energy at the death is intensely more strong than anything we've known. It's like, really is the source of why there's so much fear. So this is why living your life well, preparing for this, is so necessary. And then having a beloved like you, loving your mummy and daddy, nurturing them, taking care of them, looking them in the eye, praising them, loving them, listening, let them hear holy things, let them be peaceful. There's so many ways to prepare them so that their minds are peaceful. The grasping will still occur. But if their mind is peaceful and virtuous, that will trigger a virtuous karmic seed. Now, if you're going to kill them... And at what stage, how will that be? How will that look when they're demented, when they're really... How would it be? What would be the scenario they think that you should kill them at? What's the scenario? Have they said? You've got to know, darling.
Yeah, I need to...
You mean you haven't read their document? Why not?
I need to read it better, right.
You had better.
Yeah.
So if you're in charge, then, you know, you've just got to really, first of all, have the genuine wish to do what's best for your mummy and daddy. So do you... I'm not saying you've got to have the view of karma, but just out of interest for this conversation, do you have the view of karma?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Do they have the view of karma?
No.
Do they have faith in God?
Yeah.
They have faith in God. Well, great. You can help them enormously. This is what Lama Zopa says, that this grasping, which is this intense attachment, we need to use it to look forward to something. So my friend Lenny, who worked in California in the hospice movement, thank you, yeah, good. She said it was a given among her friends, this is like 30 years ago, that most people die with this fear, because most people have never thought about death. But she said the only ones that don't die with fear are those who've got a spiritual practice. And there's nothing holy about that, because they're the only ones who think about a future life. If you're a Christian, you think of heaven, isn't it? If you're a Buddhist, you think of a human body or whatever. So then at least they have got something to look forward to. It's using your... Lama Zopa says attachment in general is negative because you're clinging to something you can't hold on to. It just causes a nightmare. But if you can look forward to the next life, it's skillful means. Mm. He says this shows you can... Attachment to the future life can be virtuous because it can at least release your fears and make you look forward to something decent. So you can help your beloved mummy and daddy by talking about God to them, saying God loves them. They might have not thought about God for a while, but you're going to bring this conversation up. They'll be so happy to cling on to something. They know they can't cling on to each other. That's not helpful. But let's give them God and tell them God loves them. Talk about heaven, how beautiful it is, how their beloveds are all there. They'll start to romance and have fantasies about heaven. At least their minds will relax and be virtuous, and that'll help the grasping onto that, trigger a virtuous seed, and they'll die peacefully. But if they're not, and this is a trouble in the West too, and I talk about this on the weekend, we think when they're, you know, given lots of drugs, they look peaceful, we'll say. It's a load of rubbish. You know yourself, you can be lying there in a deeper sleep having a nightmare. We know that, don't we? You might look really peaceful, but you're having a nightmare. Well, the subtle consciousness is the mind that's like the dream mind, and that can be tortured. So if you've been tortured and worried and anxious before, you're going to have a dreadful, unhappy experience with your mind grasping like crazy at the subtle level, and then suddenly you pull the plug on them while their mind's having a panic attack in a dream. Thanks a lot. So unless you can know what their mind is doing, you can't play Russian roulette with them. So it's a practical issue, because when people have got a lot of suffering and are grasping, then the mind is frantic. When the mind is frantic, that's what triggers a negative seed. When the mind is peaceful, that's what triggers a virtuous seed. It's a natural thing. So the idea is to help them become peaceful, and including your dog. Your little doggy adores you. Don't kill it. Let it look at you every day. You play a mantra in its ear. You make it peaceful. You make it feel safe in your presence. And that can, and then of course it's hearing all the Buddha's teachings and the Buddha's mantras and looking at you as a human. Don't be surprised, that can help its grasping trigger a virtuous seed and get a human body.
So are you saying, okay, I got to read up on this, but if there are explicit instructions there.
Yeah, talk this book of Lama Zopa. I worked years editing it.
So
all
you're
there
saying,
laid out. What
are
to
you
do.
Saying my job is like, okay, let's say they have explicit instructions. If I get like this, my job is to just make them as peaceful as I can before
peaceful,
they get to that point.
Peaceful and virtuous.
Okay.
Each step of the way. And this is the point is, when we know ourselves in our daily lives, don't we? When you're even slightly miserable, you immediately think of whom you can turn to. Who can help me? Look, when you're a kid, you burst into tears because your sister just looked at you the wrong way. The whole world's collapsing. And you make a beeline for mummy. And she just says, oh, darling, it's all right. And suddenly you believe her. You calm down. Well, that's your role. Just by you being a solid presence. This is a key thing that Rinpoche is saying in this book. The key thing is to give this person confidence, make them calm, make them virtuous, talk about things, do practices. You are this main person in their life. And they keep the troublemakers out of the way, keep their pets out of the way because they're so attached to them. And you help them be virtuous and peaceful. This is the best gift we can give, because that's what helps the virtuous karmic seed triggered and gives them a decent human birth. And as Lama Zopa says, this is the time, if you want to help your loved ones, help them at the time of death. It's unbelievably important. And this book of Rinpoche lays all this out. Are we communicating?
Yes.
So same with the mouse. You know, keep the mouse in a safe place, say prayers to it, calm it down, let it be peaceful, and then it'll take its own... And also, every moment of happiness that we experience is the fruit of our past virtue. So that's the end of those virtuous seeds. Every moment of suffering is the fruit of our past negativity. So the having of the suffering is the finishing of those seeds. So that's marvelous. You know, so having the suffering, but the real suffering is the mental one. It's not the physical, it's the mental anguish that is the torture. And you can't medicate mental anguish. You can medicate pain, but not the mental. And that's your presence to make a person peaceful. This is massive. This is our main role in the death of your mummy, your daddy, if you're a nurse at hospital, whatever, to make people peaceful and virtuous. Because they're yearning for someone to rely upon to make them calm down, you know, and tell them everything's wonderful. Do you understand? Okay. What else?
Thank you so much.
Where are you?
Again.
Yes, darling.
I have a question. You talked about self-blame. How can I transform self-blame into self-forgiveness?
We talked about it yesterday. I told you already.
I don't.
You know the answer, darling. You really are much better than you think. Tell me what self-blame looks. Give self-blame a word. Give me the words you'd say to yourself.
Like
Speak in the microphone.
At least I lie sometimes. So I blame myself for lying.
Right. So what do you say to yourself when you lie? What are the words you might say to yourself?
I'm a bad person, but right. There are so many other good qualities that I have. That's what we discussed.
Well, stop first. Wait.
Okay.
If you just ate a bad piece of food that'll give you a bellyache, what would you say to yourself?
It was my wrong decision and I should have made it better.
Should is useless. Let's say you've eaten the bad food. So what will you say now?
I have to accept the consequences.
Yeah, but that's heavy. What's more practical? What will you say?
I have a stomachache.
No, you're being too fatalistic. You might say, how can I fix it?
Yes.
Wouldn't you?
Yes.
What a fool for eating the wrong thing. What can I do to change it? Wouldn't you say that? That would be kind. Would it be reasonable, wouldn't it?
Yes.
Okay, the same here, darling. You notice you lied. You realize, oh, what a drag. It's an old habit, you know. I've done it before. It's an old habit. So I regret lying. Why do I regret it? Because I don't want to keep lying. It's a drag for me. It's hurting me, isn't it? So then you don't say I'm a bad person because that's exaggerating. You're not a bad person. Your lying's bad. You're fine.
Okay.
So you be more precise.
Yes.
You know, you go, what a silly girl. I lied again. Drat. Then you go, what can I do to change it? So you regret it, which is what regret is, because I don't want to get this habit anymore. Then you're going to sort of have compassion for the person you misled. Then you're going to do a little practice a mantra to purify. And then you say, you know what? I'm going to make an effort to stop lying again. That's how you change it. That's purification, darling.
Is there any small practice of purification or that?
Yeah, this is the four steps.
Oh,
what I said.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Just grabbing it right there, because the four steps are all part of the process. That's it.
Okay.
It's like if you're playing the piano and you play a wrong note. You don't go, oh, I'm going to kill myself. I'm a bad person. You go, what a silly girl. I played the wrong note. Now I better play the right note. It's practical.
Yes.
There's no thought
you.
That we can't change and counteract. There's no habit we can't change. So we just got to, the key is to grab it, to notice it quickly. And then to try and turn it around then. Do you understand? And if you get the bellyache already, then you live with the consequences. It's true. But you still make a decision not to do it again. Don't you? It's just common sense. And the more awareness we have, the more we can do this process. You don't wait till you sit on your cushion to do it. You can do it every day. It's naturally. It's a very natural process, you know.
Thank you.
What else, people? We can talk about the purification aspect of it tomorrow, because we've got 2 days, haven't we? Yes, sweetheart. Back there. The back row. Oh, sorry. Coming. Yeah. Yes. Okay, good.
Very noble. Would dedicating...
A little bit louder, perhaps?
Yes. Would the dedication of the mayor to a deceased help that person's karma?
I really can't hear that. Mic seems to be not so strong.
Yes. Would dedicating the merit of a good deed to a deceased person help that person's karma?
Well, okay, let's think. It seems like the Lama's Lama's Oprah in his book, for example, is always talking about that. When you do things, so there's many practices he mentions in this book, you know, so many practices through the weeks and months before, many practices at the close time to death, at the time of death, after the time of death, and then many things afterwards, and even after a person's dead. Yes, always Rinpoche would say, and dedicate the merits of doing this practice for the person's sake. Yes, they would say like that. They would say like that. Lama's Oprah says like that. Yes. Okay, I don't quite know how it works, but that's what they say. I have to look into it. Is that okay? All right. What else, people? Yes, over here and here. Yes.
Yes, I'm so quick.
Yeah.
My wife recently passed away 9 months ago. She had brain cancer, and we had made a pact before she had gotten sick that if either one of us got sick, we'd take each other out if we got real bad.
I understand, yes.
My mom, she was laying there for 7 days.
Keeping the mic down.
She was laying there for 7 days. I had the morphine, but I was just giving her enough morphine.
Keeping the microphone. People want to hear.
The morphine that the hospice told me to give her to make her comfortable. And I couldn't give her an overdose. I wouldn't do it.
No, I understand.
I was waiting for a miracle for her to come back.
I understand. Of course you were.
So when you were saying that... you were doing them a favor by covering up their symptoms, but they could have been symptoms.
But doing what?
Like I would be
doing them a favor. What?
If you put them, gave them their wish, and let them pull the plug, or give them the morphine. But I felt.
So I'm a bit confused. You said doing them a favor. What?
Yeah, when you were answering his question, that if you had, when they were dying, you ended their suffering. You didn't know, like if you give them the drug, they would be not suffering anymore.
I didn't say that.
Oh, okay.
I'm saying that's what we think.
Oh, yeah.
But the Buddha's view would be, you don't know if you're ending their suffering, because their consciousness will continue after they're born, after they've died, and that they're going to take another rebirth. And if we can't guarantee that that'll be a good rebirth, then right. How can we say that? I mean, they're suffering. They put them from the frying pan into the fire. I didn't say that clearly enough. Really, I'm sorry I misled you.
Oh, that's okay. No, I was just...
Do you hear the point I'm making?
Yes, yes.
So did you help your wife quietly? Were you saying prayers and mantras for her and things like that?
I wasn't a Buddhist at the time, but I laid in bed with her for 7 days and held her in my arms.
Good. So she was peaceful, you think?
Well, you know, yeah. And I got up to make dinner.
And you said kind words to her in her ear and everything?
Yeah, and I called all her friends on the phone.
Yes.
And I told her she was laying here in bed. Yes. She couldn't talk, but I'm going to put the phone to her ear so you could say goodbye
wonderful,
to her.
Wonderful.
So I called everybody she knew.
Wonderful.
And I put the phone on speaker.
Yes.
And they all said, I left the room, and they all said their goodbyes.
Wonderful, darling.
But when I came back in, when she passed, she had the most peaceful, smile
there
on her face
go.
That I've never seen on anybody's face before.
That's a good sign.
That's what I thought.
Well, that's a good sign for sure, because let me tell you this. We're going to discuss again the weekend. But because the karmic seed that will be the one that will bring her to the next life is triggered before she stopped breathing, then they say that some people who die really anxious and freaked out, they really almost like have hallucinations. They're freaking and crying because they're seeing their future. So that if you look really anguished and suffering, I suppose a negative seed has been triggered. But if she looked peaceful, that shows a peaceful seed was probably triggered. So very lucky. You're very kind.
I felt that was the only saving grace from driving me crazy because of that look on her face.
I understand, darling.
So peaceful
and happy.
You
did the right thing. Well done.
Thank you.
Wonderful.
Thank you for answering that. Thank
wonderful.
You.
Yes. Anybody else?
8:24. Yes. Oh, thank you. You mentioned earlier about removing these negative seeds.
Yes.
Do I understand correctly that the process of purification is the removal of these negative
seeds? Yeah, no, we haven't even really gone into the purification process yet, which is the point of this discussion. We're going to certainly do it in more detail tomorrow.
Okay.
Right. But let's just start talking about it now. We've got a few minutes. So the point I was trying to get was the big picture about karma. The very first level is refraining from sowing more negative seeds. But the second one, which is a purification, is taking care of all the ones we've already planted. Okay? So as Lama Zopa says, we are insane not to do this practice every night. So it's good to do it at night because you're trying to take care of the end of your day, you know. And we'll go briefly now and we'll discuss more in detail tomorrow. There's four basic steps. And there's different order in the different practices, but I like this particular order. And it's the analogy is, like I was saying here, it's sort of like you've eaten poison. So if you've eaten poison, the first thing you think when you recognize you've eaten something with poison in it, you go, oh, I can't believe, what an idiot, I just don't believe I've done this, what a fool, quick, what can I do about it? Wouldn't you agree with that? You wouldn't go, oh, I ate poison, I'm such a bad person, like she did, because she lied. Because it's really logical, because we know there will be suffering consequences for me. We're really in touch with that, isn't it? But the why we have guilt is when we think, oh, I'm a bad person, so I'm going to get punished by somebody. That's what guilt is. Do you understand? Well, this regret, this first one, His Holiness answered really sweetly, and I've always said this, I've probably said this the last 20 years, this is nearly my 20th anniversary for coming here, okay? And I'm sure I say this every year. The same example. I should get new examples. His Holiness, one time, was asked, what's the difference between guilt, what we call guilt, her one, classic, I do something bad, I'm a bad person, you know? Why? Because we don't want to get punished. This is not the reason. I'm going to be found out. I'm a bad person, you know? So guilt, His Holiness put it this way, it's very sweet. He says, with guilt, you look in the past and you go, I did that, and I did this, and I did that, and I'm a bad person. We all know that one well. So just to say, before we go on, he didn't say this bit, you listen to that. What is that? That is anger. Completely anger, and you're the object. Listen to anger. You did that, and you did this, and you did that, and you're a bad person. So guilt is exactly the same, but you're the object. This is what's interesting, isn't it? And we love to do that. We are addicted to this one. It's just heartbreaking. It's like self-abuse. So that one we know spontaneously. We've practiced that for a long time. We run to it like a magnet, which is why she asked, what's the antidote? So we've got to catch that. So he said, now regret, the first part is the same. You look in the past, and I did that, and I did this, and I did that. But the second part, that's where you say, what can I do about it? That's what's optimistic. That's what's positive. But the piece that's in there that's missing, you've got to, you know, like with the poison, you know automatically that if you've eaten poison, you will suffer, isn't it? We know that part, isn't it? That's why, and that's why you regret it, isn't it? Because you don't want suffering. That's the logic of regret. You've got to know that the thing you're regretting is a thing that's going to harm you. Not it's got, you're a bad person, someone will punish you, and that takes time. So that's with the view of karma, that everything you've done that is necessarily negative, and we will join the club here, will necessarily ripen in the future as you're suffering. And this is not even compassion yet. Compassion comes second. We've got to have this. It's like compassion for ourselves. They don't talk about it like that in the Buddhist teachings, but it's a really good phrase we understand. So just like it is with eating poison, you want to respect yourself and not have agonizing suffering, so you go find an antidote. It's kind of logical, you know. That's regret. So that means it's ownership of it, and it has to have, we've got to have the courage to recognize, I did lie, I did steal, I did badmouth, I did cheat on my girlfriend, or whatever you did, you know, you did kill a million people, whatever you did. Do you understand? We've got to be, and that's scary. Because some of us either have this racking guilt and want to kill ourselves, or we live in complete denial because it's so unbearable, or we find someone else to blame. I mean, our three modes right now are guilt, blame, or denial. So that's how absurd it would be. You've eaten poison, Rabina. Oh, I'm a bad person. That's guilt. And you keep getting sicker every day, and you keep saying, I'm a bad person, never thinking, what can I do about it? I mean, it's just plain idiotic, you know. The second one is, you've eaten poison, Rabina. Who put poison in my dinner? Meanwhile, you go around still smoking your cigarettes out of the hole in your throat while you sue Marlboro. Thanks, so that's called blame. Do you understand? Do you understand? That's blame. The third one is, Rabina, you ate poison. I did not. That's denial. So we have these three. We know these really well. So we've got to grow up and say, oh, what a fool. I can't believe I did something so foolish. And you don't beat yourself up. You realize it's a habit. It's a habit, you know. You go, you're kind to yourself. You recognize you did it, and I really am sick of this. You're talking to yourself. This is a process for yourself. I call it like becoming your own friend. You've got to acknowledge what you did in the day, this life, and then, of course, countless past lives. So let's say you regret because you lied. Here I go. You know, I can't believe I did it again. It's just an old habit. But you're sort of kind because you realize it's a deeply ingrained habit, and habits are very hard to change. So I regret lying. You know why, Rabina, talking to yourself? Because I don't want this to happen to me. Just think of being lied to. Think of people not trusting your words. Just that alone. Forget about another rebirth. You go, of course I don't want that. And then think, the habit, you don't want that either. Got to be realistic, you know. I don't want the suffering. And that's the basis of regret. It's like compassion for yourself. Then you can regret any lying since the beginning of this time, any killing, anything you've ever done to any sentient being ever that will ripen as your suffering because you're sick of suffering. And then you think, next step, whom can I turn to? Where's the doctor? The second one is called reliance. And there's two parts. The first part is like the doctor. And that's our relationship with the Buddha. Now, if I'm a Christian, you don't, you know, you've got to turn to God, but this is the massive difference. You turn to God because you went against God's wishes, and you have to beg him to forgive you. That's why us, in our culture, forgive is a big word. You've got to have someone else forgive you. I'm not complaining, but that's the Christian teaching. But God, Buddha is a very nice person. He would forgive you, but it's not the issue. It's not the point. Forgiveness has got zero to do with it. Self-forgiveness, if you like, is the first step. Now, the second one is, well, where's the doctor? Whom can I turn to? Who's got the antidote that I can apply to purify this ridiculous habit and all the others? Do you understand? This, the first part is what we call refuge. And that really means you think of the Buddha, you're delighted you've got a Buddha, you've chosen to rely on the Buddha, no one's forced you, and you want to use his medicine. Do you understand? That's refuge, reliance. But the second part, they call it reliance, and this is a bit odd to us, is where you now have compassion for the others, for whom you've harmed this time. So they say it's reliance. It's the way they talk. You know, if you want to, let's say you want to help others, I'm just talking generally now, by being a doctor, you've learned all the methods of how to heal people. Well, you need suffering sentient beings, don't you? If you've never met a suffering sentient being, you can't be a doctor, can you? So you don't want them to suffer, but you need suffering sentient beings. You rely upon suffering sentient beings, so you can be a good doctor. Well, same here. You're trying to cultivate compassion now for others. First is compassion for yourself. Now is compassion for those you've harmed. So you'll think of the fleas, the people you lied to, and you'll have it's like regretting for their sake now. I regret for their sake because I know what it's like to be harmed. And then if you're brave enough, you can have compassion for those who've harmed you, if you're brave enough. But why? Because they will suffer for what they did to you. That's the basis of compassion, you know. So that's reliance. The next one is now you put your money where your mouth is and you apply the antidote. You take the remedy. And, of course, anything can be an antidote. So if you lie, also in your daily life, I forget her name. What's your name, sweetheart? I forget your name. I'm so sorry.
That's okay. Pavita.
Pavita. So the third step's like often called the antidote. So obviously if you have a tendency to lie, an immediate antidote will be to tell the truth. If you have a tendency to kill, an immediate antidote will be to save lives. That would be a great practice. But there's a very potent medicine that all the lamas really praise in the third step, the antidote, the remedy. And that's a particular meditation on a particular Buddha and the recitation of his mantra. And we'll do this tomorrow. He's called Vajrasattva. And this is said to be a really powerful medicine that acts very profoundly to help purify all negative karmas. You know, do you understand? So the third step is you do that practice. You actually do the visualization and the mantra. And that's the third step. Then the fourth step, Pabongka Rinpoche says it's the most important. It's the resolve to change, not do it again. If you regret lying because you're sick of suffering and you have compassion for those you lie to, but you never vow not to lie again, well, nothing's going to change. And that's why forgiveness is not enough. You know, let's say, you're my boyfriend. What's your name? My boyfriend. What? You're my boyfriend. What's your name?
Tim.
Tim, my boyfriend, okay? And so I'm always bad-mouthing him. Then I'm at work and I'm full of guilt and shame because I'm scared he'll reject me, so I can't wait to get home. Oh, I'm so sorry, Tim, please forgive me. And I'm looking anxiously in his eyes and he still loves me and I feel like I'm off the hook again, right? But nothing will change until I say to myself, not even to him, to myself, Rabina, I will not badmouth Tim. And you don't lie to yourself, as Lama Zopa says. If you can't say never again, because it's an old habit, when I do this practice at the end of the day, I've got to say to myself, I'll give myself a timeline. I will not badmouth Tim for 10 hours. And I'll be asleep, so I won't. So I kept my vow. So that gives you courage, and then I'll remember my vow, and then the next day I'll do it again, and before you know it, I'll stop bad-mouthing it. But until I do that fourth step, nothing will change. This is why it's most powerful. But the regret is the first one. Lama Zopa says that's the most important. That's entry into it. You've got to own that you did it. Sick of suffering, then compassion, then the antidote, then the vow not to do again. This is how you purify your mind. And as Lama Zopa says, Lama Yeshe says, but we create negativity with our mind. So we purify it by creating positivity with our mind. And there's no karma that can't be changed because it's highly dynamic. There's no imprint. There's no seed we can't remove. There is no habit we cannot change. There is no thought we can't change. That should give us such confidence. All I know is my friends in prison, when we talk about this practice, they're on the edge of their chairs. They love it, you know. Because you think I'm a bad person, I'm evil, I'm in prison forever, I killed somebody. It's like there's no chance. But there's nothing we can't change. And this is practical. This is practical, I tell you. This is practical psychology. Don't think of karma as anything but psychology. It isn't. It's your mind, okay? And we're the boss. Are we clear? So we'll talk more about it tomorrow. And we'll do it as well. Okay? Time to go home. Thank you so much. Shall we dedicate? Just do a little prayer. Sorry, just to finish. It's like I like to think of the two things bookends on the end. The beginning, we motivate, and at the end, we dedicate. So, can we do dedication? Oh, I'll sing them. Don't worry. The first one is thinking, I'd just like to put it this way. The first one is, we've been an hour and a half, a bit more. As many thoughts as there've been is as many seeds we planted, okay? And so we might not remember most of them, but don't worry, they're all gone in. It's marvelous. So we think maybe nourish these seeds with our efforts from this moment forward so that we never give up on developing our marvelous potential so that we can be a benefit to others. And then thinking in the second little prayer, may compassion grow and grow.
Lama Sangye Drogyurne Drowa Chikyang Malup par Dei sala gopasho Jang chob sem cho grin po che Ma kye pa nam ke gyo chig Kye pa nyam pa me pa yang Gong ne gong du eva sho
Thank you very much. See you all tomorrow or the next day or next life if we die tonight, okay?